Joined on the line now by Claire McCatrick. She is of the Clan Project. Claire, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
For people who aren't very familiar with Clan or may only know it by name recognition, can you sketch out your ethos?
So Clan is a collaboration of the Adoption Rights Alliance and Justice for Microphones Research, both of which I'm a co-founder. And it's a collaboration that we had with global law firm Hogan Lovells. We essentially enabled people who wanted to give evidence to the Mother and Baby Homes Commission to do so by providing free assistance with drafting legal statements, with witness statements, which witnesses could then submit to the commission. Our more recent work involves, you know, populating our website with what will become the Clan archive, you know, with witness statements that have been anonymised, but also advocating in terms of legislation that's going through the Oireachtas, obviously informed by witness testimony that we have gathered.
Now, one such piece of legislation pertains to adoption, and Clan has described it as deeply insulting, and it's a requirement in the proposed legislation for adoptees to attend an information session around privacy. What underpins that?
So, yes, so just to explain to your listeners, the idea is that for adopted people who are applying for their birth certificates, if a natural parent has registered a no-contact preference, those adopted people, if the bill goes through as is, they will have to attend a mandatory information session at which the natural parent's privacy rights will be explained to them, and it will also be impressed on them the importance of respecting the contact preference. Now, you know, we can't see any conceivable reason why this should be in the bill, because adopted people are no different to any other citizen, and they are not predisposed to be, you know, unable to understand what privacy means. We, in fact, I would argue we go the extra mile, because, given the what's at stake, you know, to make sure that other people are taken into account. So, you know, it is for us, we just simply cannot support anything that has such a discriminatory and insulting measure, you know, and we're talking about this thing on the statute books, you know, that it's in legislation, it's the law of the land, it's extraordinary.
Like the set of assumptions on which that proposed provision is based, they are really stultifying, because as you've said, the assumption seems to be that adopted people have a lesser understanding of concepts of privacy than general society if they are required, in order to access their own records, to attend seminars.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's what it stems from ultimately is this sort of this erroneous paradigm that the state and indeed many others adhere to, and that is that you've on the one hand got allegedly needy adopted people, you know, who are, you know, mad to find new relationships with natural family members. On the other hand, you've got allegedly closeted natural mothers who are terrified of their adult children arriving on their doorstep. Now, for those of us who are actually working in the area for the last few decades, you know, the reality couldn't be further from that. You know, it's in fact many mothers want contact. In fact, not all adopted people want contact. Indeed, you know, as I said, adopted people are more than mindful of other people's privacy. Moreover, information and contact are completely separate things. They're, you know, information about yourself, and might I add, this information session centres on access to your birth certificate. Now, this is a public document. Every citizen in the country can walk into the General Register office and obtain anybody's birth certificate. So, you know, we're not talking about passing over state secrets here. We're talking about a person's own identity, their birth certificate, the document that shows they were born and where they were born. So, you know, it is nonsensical to us. apart from anything else.
Now, we've had many, many decades, Claire, in Ireland, where you know better than I that the rights in terms of the concept of adoption of one party have been placed significantly above those of adopted people. And arguably we have a situation here where the feelings of birth parents are being placed significantly above those of adopted people.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because this is all kind of based on this really, really unhelpful myth, you know, that the adopted person, you know, that they're the only ones who are interested in finding out information, which is not true, because, you know, natural mothers certainly do as well. And, you know, it's this unhelpful culture of sort of secrecy and shame and assuming that everybody wants to keep, you know, things under wraps. You know, and in reality, that's not the situation, you know. In reality, you know, a lot of the times natural mothers are, you know, they're simply trying to cope with what happened to them. I mean, and I think we've only literally, you know, begun to scratch the surface of what actually happened and how that impacted on women who had to relinquish their children and walk away and pretend like they never had a child. And instead of, you know, compounding that shame, compounding that secrecy, it's time for the government to lead the way and use this as an opportunity to explain to mothers, well, look, we believe you. What happened to you? We think it's terrible, and you no longer have to bear this burden of secrecy and shame. And the same for adopted people, that you no longer have to bear this burden either, that you are equal in the eyes of the law as well. It's not a question of one set of people against the other. We all went through this together. There's no hierarchy of pain. There is no hierarchy of grief here. We're all trying to kind of make our way through life having had this happen to us. But, you know, I believe the minister wants to do the right thing here, but he needs to listen, because this isn't how to do it.
Claire McCatrick of the Clan Project, thank you indeed for joining us there. We can expect the weather to change, because today, believe it or not, is the last day of the leaving cert, so I would imagine we'll be plunged back into a traditional dank and dull Irish summer after today. But the 29th of June has prompted an advisory by DrinkAware, which is urging parents to have a conversation about alcohol regarding the leaving cert celebrations and the summer ahead. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Sheena Horgan. She's Chief Executive of DrinkAware. Sheena, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Why in particular is a conversation needed now?
Well, to be honest, it's not that it's needed now ahead of any other time. I just think when you have the likes of a leaving cert celebration, then you've got a very good reason to have the conversation. You've a good subject, if you like, that you can discuss. And I think in particular, given what our young people and our leaving cert students in particular have gone through in the last 12, 15 months, and the pressure that they've been under, and now being able to release it, going, the exams are over, the assessments are over, the summer is ahead, you know, they are absolutely going to want a deserved celebration and a release. And so it's a perfect time to have that conversation, go, okay, well, what does that celebration and release look like? And so we're urging people, to be honest, as we do around every leaving cert celebration, but particularly this one, to, you know, have that conversation. And it's about, I think, having a conversation as opposed to talking to. So it's a talking with more than
It's not a lecture.
Absolutely. And to be honest, I mean, any parent listening, I'm a parent of four myself, and I have a leaving cert student as well, so I'm kind of trying to practice what I preach, you know, very much so. But I know, you know, you have to have conversations, and you have to go about it in a particular way that will suit your child. And it's a perfect time to have it, and it's worth having now, especially because apart from the celebrations, we're going into the summer. And hopefully there will be more outdoor socialising allowed. And how can we do so safely? How can we keep our kids safe? And so it's absolutely worth having that chat about alcohol.
What should be the elements of that conversation, Sheena?
I think the first thing is, as I say, it's a two-way street. So there's a bit of listening going on there and discussing. And I suppose asking your student, your child, you know, what is it? How are they going to celebrate? Who are they celebrating with? Will there be alcohol involved? You know, are they intending to, thinking about having a drink? bearing in mind that probably the vast majority of Leaving Cert students now will be 18. So it's trying to figure out what it is that they're looking for, but also talking about, you know, options and alternatives if they don't want to drink. Because I think as adults, especially in Ireland, we make the assumption this is a rite of passage, isn't it?
But also that the vast majority of people in any given group drink, and that is categorically not the case.
Just isn't. And, you know, we do an alcohol education program in secondary schools, and it's one of the things that we impress upon the students. We're going, not everybody does, either child underage or actually adult. There's a good swathe of about 25% typically over the years that does not drink. And then we know from our own data, other data that we have, there's about a quarter to a third of the adult drinking population who would like to drink less or would like to explore cutting out. So it's a good time now to be talking about this, because that concept of sober curious, which is quite trendy, or finding alternatives, or finding alternative occupations, alternative products and all the rest, is very much in vogue. So we can capture that and have that conversation. So that's kind of the first thing. Have a discussion. Try and understand what it is your student wants. How do they want to celebrate? With whom? Who be involved? And I think when you're talking about who else is involved, it's worth having a chat about peer pressure and what pressure they may or may not be under. And it will vary according to different groups. But I think talking through how your child is going to cope with that. So if somebody is going, I go on, kind of thing, how will they react to it? And talking through what are the excuses they can give? What are the things they can say? And for some, it may be just going, look, my mother will kill me. You've met my mother, she'll kill me.
That's the shield that they need, well and good, use it.
Absolutely. And it's I think we do our kids great service when we explore those options. And that's about building the resilience and the life skills. You know, in fairness, as adults, we know if we were in a pub celebrating something and decided, actually, you know what, I'm not going to have a drink tonight, or I'm not going to have another one, that we can be put under pressure. So it's similar. We have our own excuses and things to do. And I think talking about alternatives, especially when there are so many, you know, alternative products and alternative things they can do, is another conversation that's worth having. And I mean, everybody knows their child best. And what I do know as a parent for years of advocacy in the children's space, most parents think that the peers have greater influence. Actually, we still have a huge amount of influence, even up until their early 20s. We just need to use it and deploy it, you know, in a way that works for us and works for them.
Should you get into the technicalities of units and frequency of drinking, et cetera, in that kind of conversation, Sheena, or would you lose the room there, really?
Yeah. Do you know, it's a very good question. And again, maybe it's down to the individual. Needless to say, my poor children fully understand what standard drinks are, what the guidelines are and everything else, because they hear it from me, but also they're of an age, you know, the eldest being 22, 23. But I think it's worth discussing out your child's kind of perception and understanding, and there will be some who want to understand that. What is absolutely worth explaining is how alcohol works and the effect it has on our bodies and our minds and our well-being. And I think in particular, even as adults, it's something we should always bear in mind. You know, alcohol can reduce anxiety in some settings, but it can also cause anxiety in some settings. So if you have a teenager, a young person who wants to celebrate with their friends, maybe isn't feeling great, especially given that the period we have, maybe they're feeling stressed, they may think alcohol will ease it, when actually it may exacerbate the situation. And I think it's worth letting them know that. You know, it's we tend to use, in Ireland, we often use alcohol as a crutch and a coping mechanism, but it's not a very effective coping mechanism, really. So I think talking about that and talking about the impact on bodies and brains and just mental health and well-being is absolutely a conversation worth having, without even going into, you know, how many standard drinks and low-risk weekly guidelines and everything else. But the reason why the guidelines are there is because excessive drinking, binge drinking, has a serious effect on our mental health and well-being, as well as our physical well-being. And I think that's something today's teenagers and young people are far more savvy about than I certainly would have been, and most of their parents would have been at their age. And even as adults, you know, we're increasingly conscious of that. So I think that's a chat worth having.
Sheena Horgan, Chief Executive of Drink Aware, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the Immigrant Council of Ireland's call for DARE participants for a political internship. Now, there's been a brand new programme launched here in County Kildare and indeed across Ireland by the Immigrant Council of Ireland. And to tell us all about it, I'm joined on the line now by its integration manager, Teresa Buczkowska. Teresa, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, everyone. Thank you.
This is potentially a really, really important programme because I think pretty much in every country across the world, it is mirrored that it's very, very difficult for people who are migrants to a country to begin becoming involved in political and community life. And this is one way of giving people a step up that ladder.
That's right. That's correct. We've done research around migrant political participation in Ireland, and we found that migrants face additional barriers to be politically active, both as voters and as candidates in local elections. And we run this pilot project, or a similar pilot project, in 2018, and we found that it was very effective to introduce migrants to local politics, but also to allow local councillors to learn more around migrant issues in their local area.
So how it's going, I'm sure it's available in every county in Ireland, but we'll just speak about here in County Kildare. So a person will contact you, Teresa, saying, look, wasn't born in Ireland, but I've been living here for a while. I would love to get more involved in political life here in my local community. I want to take part in the programme. What happens then?
So we are looking for both migrant and councillors from local areas who are willing to take part in this program, because we want to give a very practical experience to migrants in their local areas about politics in local area. So it's very important that we have both migrant candidates and councillors in one local area willing to work together. So we're really calling out now for anyone, any migrants interested in political life, get in touch with us. There is an application form online, but also Kildare-based councillors, please, if you are interested in hosting an intern for 12 weeks, get in touch and we'll put you in touch with a local migrant.
There are 40 councillors on Kildare County Council, and I think that they are all currently at a special meeting this afternoon, but I would imagine that there are many of them that would absolutely be interested in exploring this further. You say, Teresa, it's a 12-week programme, and I imagine a lot of what happens in the internship will be collaborative between the councillor and the person undertaking the internship. But are there any key goals that you would like both to meet together?
Yes, so with this internship, we want to break barriers for migrants for political participation. So we want the intern to learn about what is local government doing, what are the duties of local councillor, and give them confidence to consider perhaps running in local elections in 2024. And then on the other hand, we want to bring migrant communities closer to the local government. We want local councillors to build connections with migrant communities and encourage them also to reach out to local government and also be active voters in local elections. So I think it works really both ways, and supporting migrant communities and councillors into working together towards common goal of integration of migrant communities.
I think that this mentorship program really shows that integration doesn't just happen, it is made. It requires everybody to buy into it.
Everyone has a responsibility and duties for integration. It's not only migrants, it's also the local community have to reach out, make opportunities open to migrants. We need to realize that migrants face additional barriers in all aspects of life. So making those additional programs that support migrants reaching their potential and having opportunities that they can transform into really life-changing opportunities, this is very important to make integration work.
Just we'll talk, I suppose, about the nuts and bolts, the logistical matters involved. Is there a deadline for applications either by people who are potential interns or by councillors?
Yes, there is. The 23rd of July is the deadline for both migrants and councillors to send us the interest. So we'll encourage everyone to really check our social media and website for any details how to apply and where to find further information. But for anyone interested to learn more about what the scheme is about and what are the terms and conditions, we are inviting everyone to attend our public online information session. Tomorrow at 6 p.m. we have a session for migrants, and then on Thursday at 6 p.m. we have a session for councillors. And that's an online, you have to register to attend those events. That will be an opportunity for you to learn more, but also to ask questions.
Well, Teresa Butchkowska, Integration Manager at the Immigrant Council of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. And if anybody would like to find out more information about that, you can go onto the Immigrant Council's website, immigrantcouncil.ie. Very big announcements in terms of culture at third level institutions, educating people about consent, but also enabling people who have been subjected to sexual violence or harassment to report that anonymously. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Claire Austick, Vice President of Welfare at the Union of Students in Ireland. Claire, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having me.
Delighted to do so. In some ways, this feels like a long time coming, and in other ways, it seems kind of quick, if that makes sense.
Yeah, certainly. So students' unions and the Union of Students in Ireland for years would have been calling for more action in relation to consent education and policies and procedures to be made available at third level education. And this year in particular, over the last 18 months, we would have seen a lot of political will, political leadership and buy-in from the whole sector in terms of universities, RTs and colleges really committing to addressing this as an issue and making it a priority. This is something that we're very happy to see in terms of action plans. Not only does it recognise that it's a prominent issue at third level, but it also, I suppose, identifies that we all have a part to play in addressing this issue and making sure that we provide a safer and more respectful environment for students on campus.
And it also arguably seeks to empower people going into their adult working lives as to how to correctly give and receive consent and what precisely constitutes consent.
Certainly, and this is this is all about. It's about promoting consent. It's about empowering individuals to realise what consent is, how they communicate it, what they're comfortable with, what they're not comfortable with, and how to communicate that. So the likes of consent workshops empowers and encourages individuals to understand what consent means and gives them the tools and language to communicate that. In terms of the disclosure training, it allows staff on campuses to support students in the event of disclosure of sexual violence and harassment. And the likes of targeted initiatives continues the conversation, because a one-hour consent workshop isn't going to change the mindset or behaviour that people have learned over the last 10 years.
Who is going to design and deliver these consent classes? Will that be up to each individual third level institution, or will they be following a curriculum set by the department?
So there's different groups, for example, so active consent or UCC bystander intervention. So they would be the, I suppose, organisations leading in this area. So they would have devised online workshops that would have been delivered at the start of the term. They also provide training to consent facilitators to allow to deliver these, workshops in person as well, once it's allowed to under public health guidelines. So there definitely is, an outline recommendation in terms of how to follow it. But the likes of active consent and UCC bystander intervention would also be leading in this area and providing that advice.
In terms then of the anonymous reporting tools and disclosure training, because I note that the number of people who disclosed anonymously sexual harassment and other matters of sexual violence, and I know that the Minister is keen to facilitate anonymous reporting. What way will those tools be established? Because the manner of accessing them, the way in which you can use them, and what will be done with the information once it has been collected by somebody reporting anonymously will have a huge impact on whether or not people use the tool.
Yeah, certainly. So the tool is still in development at the moment and hopefully will be made available at the start of the next academic term. And the way it'll operate is that people will be able to use it throughout their term So if something happens at the start of the college course or throughout, that too will be made available at all stages in the academic course. And then I suppose in terms of the feedback and the findings, they'll be analysed on a yearly basis, but also throughout, to ensure that as emerging trends arise, that colleges can react appropriately, and then also nationally be able to, I suppose, identify what's happening across the island. So different initiatives, policies can be reviewed, and ensure that, I suppose, the needs of students are being met locally but also nationally.
Do you feel that, this suite of moves and measures, Claire, is sufficiently robust?
So first of all, in terms of the action plans, this is something that we definitely welcome. It's about institutions being transparent, accountable, and also being monitored on the progress that they're making or not making. So in terms of being able to review how much progress is being made in an area, it's really, really great and positive to see. And the annual reports will be made to the HTA as well. In terms of the different individual action plans and what's in them, something that we're hoping to see is that, I suppose, with the consent workshops, that there's continuous information available. This is a broader picture. It has to be a holistic approach with staff, students, admin, the whole campus environment to really change a culture. So the conversation is slowly starting. A lot of progress has been made the last 18 months, but we cannot take our foot off the pedal and it needs to continue. So that's something we're hopeful about, and we will be certainly pushing for forward as well.
Well, Claire Austick, Vice President for Welfare at the Union of Students in Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us.